very good evening to all of you. I'm very happy to be here once again in this gathering, in the program hosted at Ernst & Young. I've been here a couple of times before, and I do recognize a few faces, but not that many. I'm happy to see many new faces as well this evening. I was asked to speak today on the topic, being in the moment. And I was really reflecting on this and thinking, what exactly this means, being in the moment. And I believe, as Vijay was pointing out, it's a topic of a lot of discussion nowadays, especially in corporate circles, and even in general, in the minds of the public, being in the moment, being here, now, and such phrases. And I thought I'd take a bit of a different perspective. I'd rather speak from a more spiritual point of view than merely from a psychological point of view. The spirit and the psyche are actually interconnected. Originally, the word psyche anyway meant soul. So therefore, psychology originally was a study of the soul. And then somewhere down the line, everything became cross. So psychology became study, not of the soul, but of the human mind. There's a difference between the mind and the soul, actually. And as time went on, then it became a study of human actions, of human behavior. So gradually psychology has become grosser and grosser. But the original meaning was to study the soul, actually. Logos means science, psyche means the soul. So psychology originally meant science of the soul. So I'll try to connect these concepts up a little bit. I won't make the lecture too long, I promise. And I'd like to have more time for questions and discussions as we move on. And don't be intimidated by the stick I carry with me. Although I do sometimes use it when people ask me difficult questions. Nevertheless, I trust you will not ask me very difficult questions. Being now, being in the moment. Why is this a topic in the first place? Naturally, because we are not able to be here in the moment. We are not able to be present now. Physically we are, but mentally perhaps we are not. Or sometimes we are, and sometimes we are not. And we all are aware, only too painfully, of how fickle, restless the mind is. And even as I'm speaking, and I'm talking to you about this topic, I can assure you, your mind has wandered. Your mind has thought of other things apart from what I'm speaking right now. Am I right?
Yes.
Did you think about perhaps what you are to do today, tonight, later, or what you did at work a little earlier in the evening, or you remember someone whom you have to send a message to and you think it's too impolite to do it now? So you've got thoughts that come in and rotate all over. So the mind is like a whirlpool. It's like a cauldron, smoldering cauldron of thoughts. Coming up and down, relentlessly, harassing us. And as Vijay explained, 50 to 70,000 thoughts a day. And there's some controversy there about the numbers. Someone says 80,000, someone says it's an exaggeration, it's just 15,000, 20,000. And others defend the theory of 60,000 to 80,000. Be that as it may, we all know that the mind is exceptionally restless, very turbulent, very obstinate. And it moves, the movements of the mind are very swift, very rapid, random. Sometimes they don't make sense. Why the mind hops from and flits from topic to topic. without any pattern, without any logic or reason, without any apparent provocation or any stimulus. And you can see your thoughts, study your thoughts as you're sitting here in this lecture. Although I'd rather you pay attention to what I'm saying. But still, in the back of your mind, you'll notice the mind moves. And the thoughts that come into your mind are very often not connected at all. It's moving from topic to topic and topic to topic, and you really don't know why. Sometimes you're sitting in one place doing one thing, and some random thought that has to do with your childhood, for example, suddenly comes up, and you remember a childhood friend for no reason. It just comes into your mind. And you're having a jolly good time somewhere else, and you suddenly, for no reason, remember some unpleasant incident that happened a few days ago. So these are things that happen in the mind. Even when the mind is very calm, apparently, for the time being, all of a sudden, a few bubbles of thoughts will rise, one after the other. And if you do your arithmetic, 80,000 thoughts a day roughly amounts to about one thought a second, assuming you sleep for about 6 hours. And if you sleep for longer, and the equation works out even higher. And mind you, even in sleep, the mind is active. When we dream, the mind actually moves very rapidly. The mind can be very active. There are three states of consciousness that the Vedic scriptures talk about. And one is called wakefulness, in which our physical body is active, and our mind is also active. The second stage is the stage of dreaming. And that's when the body is inactive, but the mind is active. And sometimes when the mind becomes hyperactive in the dream state, it can also cause actions pertaining to the body. You may be aware of people who shout in their sleep when they've had a nightmare, or perhaps people who talk in their sleep. I knew somebody who walked in his sleep. It was quite frightening the first time we saw it. And then I know people at least who shout in their sleep. That's happened. Because when a dream becomes so terrifying that it has its effect on the body. But generally it's the mind that is active and not the body. And then you have the state of deep sleep, wherein even the mind is active. But there's something else that remains active even when the mind is not active. If that were not so, then we wouldn't be able to awaken from sleep. Then we would fall asleep and not wake up. That would be the end of the story. But the fact that we wake up and that we can still feel sensation means that there is some consciousness there which underlies all these three states of consciousness. And that's called the spiritual state of consciousness. In Sanskrit, it's called samadhi or turiya. There are different words to explain that. That indicates that apart from the gross physical body, apart from the subtle intelligence in the mind, there is another spiritual element, a spiritual entity, which is the real you and the real me, which is soul. And that soul is actually responsible for our consciousness. It is actually the source and the symptom of consciousness. And that is what energizes the mind, keeps it active. And in this way, the mind fluctuates in these three states of consciousness. But eventually, if we want to be focused, if we want to transcend the random fluctuations of the mind which only cause agitation and disturbance, we will have to come to the spiritual platform of consciousness. And a little more of that later. Now, I will also refer to a few concepts that are given in the ancient book of knowledge from India called the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita speaks about some very interesting concepts that have a lot of utility in the modern day and age as well. And this concept is a concept of the three modes of nature. Everything in the world around us can be classified in terms of three modes, called the mode of goodness, the mode of passion, and the mode of ignorance. The mode of ignorance is characterized by, well, ignorance. The mode of passion is characterized by, well, passion. And the mode of goodness is characterized by goodness. And when the mind is in the mode of goodness, it behaves in one way, in the mode of passion in another way, and in the mode of ignorance in yet another way. And our mind, as normal individuals living in this world with all our struggles and ambitions and desires and so on, we also move between these modes. Have you felt a time when you are feeling calm and peaceful within yourself? Yes, you are in the mode of goodness. Have you felt a time when you are extraordinarily agitated about something, or you are possessed by some very strong emotion or desire? Then your mind is in the mode of passion. Have you also experienced a state of mind wherein you feel morose, dull, lethargic, or perhaps excessively violent? Yes, then that is the state of ignorance. So each has its own attributes. So if you look at the mind in the mode of goodness, what words would come to mind? Sober, peaceful, full of knowledge, clarity of thought, happiness, satisfaction and contentment. These are words that come to mind when we speak of the mind in the mode of goodness. The mind in the mode of goodness is able to focus and concentrate on things far easier than the mind in the other two modes. So there is steadiness in the mind in the mode of goodness. The mind in the mode of passion, as opposed to this, is restless, turbulent, unsteady, flickering, unable to focus on any one thing at a given time, but keeps flitting from thought to thought, from desire to desire. It's also possessed by extremes of desires, passions, ambitions, and is characterized by occasional happiness and occasional distress, and we fluctuate between the two. And sometimes the happiness may be extreme. It's not happiness actually, it's just pleasure. Extreme pleasure and sometimes extreme pain. And we also gravitate between these two. The mind in the mode of ignorance is one which is dull, which is lethargic, morose, sad, which is bewildered, confused, where one doesn't know what to think, what to do, and sometimes it can be violent to the point of being crazy. So how does one come to the mode of ignorance? What are those factors that stimulate the mind to be in the mode of ignorance? It's association. Association with things, with people, with events, with places, with times. So when the mind associates with these, it acquires the quality of that it associates with. So let's say alcohol. Now alcohol is a substance in the mode of ignorance. So if I partake of alcohol, and perhaps take, I won't, but I'm just taking an example. If I partake of alcohol, and excessively so, then I'm associating with the mode of ignorance. And then it takes its toll on my mind, which becomes crazier and crazier. It loses its sense of balance, its sense of discrimination, sense of understanding, sense of stability. And the mind may say and force us to say things that may be quite nonsensical. It may force us to act in ways that also will be very troublesome for us and embarrassing for us. There are other substances, you know, have drugs and so on, that's also in the mode of ignorance. Similarly, when one is in deep sleep, that's a state of the mode of ignorance. But that's essential for us, because without that you cannot function. The mode of passion, here you have all sorts of impetuses for worldly pleasures. The desire for name, for fame, for prestige, for power, for money, for physical pleasures of this world, for good food, good clothes, flashy living, living the good life, sex, and so on. So when one is possessed by desires for these things, then the mind is in the mode of passion. It can never be peaceful, because the mind in the mode of passion is always hankering for more, 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 and forever dissatisfied as well. So the characteristic of the mind in the mode of passion is, it's hankering and yet it's dissatisfied even after obtaining its object. Because once the object is attained, then the mind again becomes disappointed. It wants more. And even after having it, perhaps a point comes when the mind says no more of that. Let's say you're eating a very good meal that you wanted to eat, and you eat and eat, and a point comes when you say, no, I don't even want to hear the word food. I'm full. So that's the nature of the mind in the mode of passion. And the nature of mind in the mode of goodness is when you associate with things that are very calming, that are spiritual, and for example, the early morning hours, you see, you're in harmony with nature. Let's say you're alone and you're watching the sunrise and you're watching the beauty of nature in open, green, open spaces, and you're reading a nice book of philosophy or something like that. The mind is calm, you're peaceful. So we can see in our daily life, now look back upon how your mind functions throughout the day. Consider, for example, how the mind behaved today. How did it go? Take a few moments to think about how your mind moved between these modes. From the time you were in bed, you woke up, and then went through your daily activities all the way till now, until you go back to bed. The mind goes through these ups and downs, like a Ferris wheel, sometimes this way and sometimes that way. And depending on the kind of modes we are associating with, those modes will predominantly affect the state of our mind. And therefore somebody, according to the nature of his or her association, may be more in the mode of goodness, someone more in the mode of passion, someone more in the mode of ignorance. And accordingly, the mind will be sober or not so. It will be agitated or not so. So the mind actually is very difficult to control. It is a thing of its own. It has its own rules. It doesn't like to obey anybody. And the mind, as the poet Milton has said, I think, is a thing in itself. It makes heaven out of hell and hell out of heaven. So it's the mind that troubles us. It's the mind that gives us pleasure. So controlling the mind, therefore, is the key. The reason we are not able to be here in the moment is because the mind is not in the mode of goodness. The influence of the mind of passion, of the mode of passion, the mode of ignorance are so strong that they distract us. They take us away from the mode of goodness. We would like to be calm, we would like to be peaceful, but the three modes of nature act very, very powerfully. And therefore we find we are not able to focus our mind on anything for any length of time. So the great yogis, they learn to focus their mind, and that requires years and years and perhaps a lifetime of very hard struggle to tame this one thing, the mind. Actually, different stages of meditational focus are described or are named differently depending on how long you can keep that focus. If you can keep it in focus for a few seconds, it's one thing. If you can keep it in focus for a few minutes, it's another thing. If you can do it longer than 10 minutes, it's another thing. So even a few minutes is a big thing. Where the mind flits every second, we're talking of focusing for 1 minute, that's a lot. So we also talk about different kinds of meditation, especially we talk about chanting the names of God. And sometimes there are new people who start chanting, and then they say, you know, well, my mind wanders, but sometimes I'm able to sit. I think every few minutes it wanders. So I said, no, every second it wanders. We try to bring it back, and then again the mind wanders. It's like a monkey. Have you ever seen a monkey that's peaceful? Have you seen a monkey that sits quietly? Or let alone a monkey, let's look at a small child. Except when the child is sleeping, the child is always restless. Always doing something or the other. You can't keep it quiet. So that's the nature of the mind. Now imagine, now this is the state of the mind in the mode of goodness. So imagine what happens to the state when you're in the mode of passion, and even more in the mode of ignorance. Just give some alcohol to the monkey and see what happens. What does it do? What happens to the monkey? So taking intoxication is like that for the mind. Anyway, it's restless, it's turbulent. And on top of that, we aggravate the situation by taking these artificial substances. In the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, who is the person for whom Krishna speaks the Bhagavad Gita, when he hears about the process of yoga and how we must focus our mind on something higher than matter, on spiritual things, after hearing the description, Arjuna tells Krishna, that's impossible. You know, what you're asking me to do, to control the mind and focus it on something spiritual, is not possible. Because the mind is restless, it's turbulent. And to control the mind is more difficult than to control the raging wind. A hurricane or a cyclone or a thunderstorm, you could even control that conceivably. Actually, you can't. But even if you did, but controlling the mind is more difficult than that. Today we're talking a lot about freedom, isn't it? Everybody wants a free world. We've come a long way. We've abolished slavery in the world. We're trying to abolish discrimination in terms of race and ethnicity and so on and so forth. So we're trying to come to a platform where we're all free from different types of bondage. Bondage of poverty, bondage of prejudices of various sorts. But do we realize that the biggest bondage that we have, the biggest form of slavery that has not been abolished and nobody talks about, it is slavery to us, or bondage to our mind. We're enslaved by our mind. We keep on doing what our mind says. I narrate this example often about this lady who came to see me one time with her son who was 10 or 11 years old. And she said, you know, I have a problem with my son. He doesn't listen to me. And he's very arrogant with me. He answers rudely when I ask him. Sometimes he doesn't answer me at all. He doesn't do what I ask him to do. And I'm really at my wit's end. I don't know what to do with this boy. So he was sitting there, sweet as ever, looking as innocent as anything. And then I asked him, so you don't listen to your mother? He says, no. I said, why not? She said, I don't listen to anyone. I said, really? And I was thinking, just look at it. He's only 10 or 11 years old, but such a strong ego. That's the nature of the mind. That's the way it is from childhood. Even try telling a little baby, well, the baby has its own mind. The baby wants to do what it wants to do. You can control maybe a kingdom, but you can't control a baby because it has its own mind. So I asked him, oh, so you don't listen to anybody? He says, no. I said, so when your mind says, don't listen to mommy, you don't listen to mommy, say yes. When your mind says you want to eat, you eat, yes. When your mind says sleep, you sleep, yes. When your mind says study, you study, yes. And I asked him these questions about, you know, 10 or 15 such questions, and each time he said yes. So I said, aren't you listening to your mind? Because your mind keeps changing. Now you want to study. After a minute you close your book and say, I don't want to study. You're whimsically acting. You just do one thing now, you do exactly the opposite the next moment, and something else the third moment. So you are listening to your mind, aren't you? I don't know how much I was able to penetrate into his mind, but I hope he got the point. The point is that even though we talk of so much freedom, the real freedom is freedom from enslavement to the whims and vagaries and obstinacy and restlessness of the mind. The real enemy is within us. It's not outside us. We needn't blame anybody else for our trials and tribulations. It's all here, within us. Therefore the challenge. So real freedom will come when we control our mind. We can't control the world. That's not possible. People have tried. It's not possible. But what we can succeed in is to control our mind. And it's only by controlling the mind that we can relish life. Otherwise now, we're sitting here in one position, in one place, at one time, but we're not able to relish it. Because the mind goes elsewhere. We're not able to be here in the moment. Because the mind keeps distracting us every now and then. We're bombarded with these influences. So how can we claim to be free? So the modern world is anything but free. In fact, the enslavement is rising day by day. To control the mind, just like to control the body when we have a disease, there are two kinds of things we need to do. One is positive and the other is negative. Those that are positive, the positive measures that we take, it lifts our consciousness. It lifts the state of the mind from the mode of ignorance to the mode of passion to the mode of goodness. And from the mode of goodness, it takes us to a higher spiritual platform. That's why we take recourse to spiritual practices. And by doing these things, we come to a higher level where we transcend matter. And then the mind is automatically dovetailed with spiritual desires which are calm and which are very fulfilling, which give us a sense of joy, not just of peace, but of bliss actually. And also there are negative restrictions, or there are negative rules which we need to follow in order that our mind doesn't get channeled into lower states of consciousness, which then create even further disturbance. And when we are in the lower modes of nature, we cannot focus our mind at anything at any time. We cannot be in the present or in the moment at any given time. Let's consider some of the negative things first, before we come to the positives. What are those negatives that actually impede our peace of mind, that come in the way of us being here in the moment? You know, the world in the political field has talked a lot about weapons of mass destruction, isn't it? Nuclear bombs, nuclear missiles. Who was it who said? I don't quite remember. Guided missiles and misguided men, yes? So we have got missiles and we have nuclear bombs, hydrogen bombs, chemical bombs, dirty bombs, all sorts of weapons of mass destruction. And as horrific as these may be, and as large scale in their capacity to cause destruction they may be, but there's something that's even more destructive than these things. Weapons of mass destruction destroy the physical body. WMDs. But there's another kind of WMDs. And I have them here on display for you. And they're all here. You see this? It's called a weapon of mass distraction. And because of this, it causes mass destruction. All these little things. They look very innocent, very harmless. So helpful to us. It helps us connect with the world, keep in touch with the world. It helps us to tell people what's in our mind. Yes, and what happens to it? Most of the world, what does it do with Google? Go Ogle. That's what we do. 90% of the internet is pornography. That's what we do. My Yahoo. Yes, Maya who? Maya means illusion. The mind is in Maya, illusion. And have you noticed, television, tell lie vision? Yes. And also have you noticed the interesting words we have? What is it that drives all these things? What do you need? You need to log into what? The net? The web? Yes, we are caught in the net. We are caught in the web. Surely and securely, we are trapped like a fly caught in the spider's web. We are caught like a fish in the fisherman's net. That's the web and that's the net. The biggest distracting and destructive influences of the modern age. Now, gone are the days. I can't call them good old days because, you know, for all sorts of addictions, nothing is good. But gone are the days when life was simpler and addictions were, you know, alcohol and cigarettes and things of that sort. Innocent sort of, you know, addictions, harmful as they may be. And today you have addictions of a different league altogether. Alcohol and drugs and tobacco are passé, they are all now. Things of the past, they're ordinary things. Now this is the real thing. This is the addiction. This is the thing that distracts us more than anything else. And we have experience with this. On the streets, everywhere I go, it's catching up everywhere, everybody's like that. Employers give it to their employees so that they can stay connected. And they do indeed stay connected, but not always with the official world. They stay connected with the whole world and with the office world. The lure for staying in touch is so pervasive and so strong that we are in touch with the whole world, but we lose touch with ourselves. That's the problem. How can we be in the present, in the moment, if we've lost touch with ourselves? This has taken away the last iota of our privacy. This has intruded into the innermost recesses of our consciousness. It has rudely come in and taken over every little moment of our private time. I know of students, I do spend a lot of time with students, I know some students who wake up in the middle of the night to check. Whether it's Twitter, Facebook, whatever it is that they check. They can't sleep. They can't function. Today people are addicted. They can't function without looking down. Their fingers are restless. You can almost see them moving like this. And it's serious business. Psychologists and psychiatrists are now really concerned about this. Now these are new mental diseases coming up, mental health issues coming up. One time, his friend had some anxiety issues, some things about health and, you know, So he went to a health professional. And the health professional asked him many questions, the routine questions. And one of the interesting questions he asked him was, do you feel your fingers moving like this?
Do you feel you want to move your fingers?
Is there some irresistible urge to move your fingers like that? He didn't understand what he was getting to. Well, do you feel you're hearing something? You're about to hear some ring or some buzz? Do you feel? Yeah, actually I feel that. So these are new phenomena coming up, ringsiety. Yes. Now there'll be other things coming up, you know, whatever it may be, Twitter-siety or whatever it is. And even at the workplace, now it's becoming a big operation. Because even when there's a meeting going on, you'll have, I'm sure there'll be many people who still steal a glance at their phone, their smartphone. And I read an article in one of the newspapers here which said that 80% of people feel annoyed when other people, in the midst of a meeting, they start checking their phones for messages or sending off some urgent messages. And the statistic the author says of this article is interesting because it means everybody has double standards. Because if 80% feel like that, it means that they themselves are responsible for what they get annoyed by. So when others do it, they feel very annoyed. But when they do it, it's just necessary to do. It's important that we have to do it. So we're all there. 60% of teenagers, this article says, and 33 to 35% of adults are addicted to this. Heavy, strong addiction. And addiction is a serious word in psychology. You know, you have Alcoholics Anonymous and so on. And I don't know about England, but India is starting. Can you imagine? You have a place for net de-addiction. Yes, I'm serious. Net de-addiction. There are psychological experts now who are dealing with this. It doesn't leave you a moment of peace. And here's the thing. It does make you... It does get you connected to the world, for sure. But the point is, it gets you connected to everything that's distant from you. It makes that which is distant come very close to you. But conversely, it makes that which is very close to you become very distant. You're sitting next to someone, but you're not talking to that person. You're far away talking to someone in a Kadaguru or something. They say, here's the person who's come to meet you. And earlier was a time when you went into a tube and you struck up a nice conversation with your neighbor and had a nice chat and then reached your place of work in a good mood. But now nobody talks. I took a few trips down the tube. Nobody was talking. They were all quiet. And only one person, God bless him, was reading a book. One person, I almost felt like going up and congratulating him. So my dear sir, you deserve some kind of prize. And I saw a hilarious video clip that somebody sent about, you know, this messaging thing and how everybody is so busy, they're walking on the street, they're doing this. It's quite hilarious somehow. I don't know, otherwise I might have wanted to show it to you. How can you expect to be relishing the moments of your life if you're just there? You're restless, you just can't be at one place. Technology undoubtedly has its benefits. The mobile phones, your apps, your computers undoubtedly have benefits. I also use them. But when the mind is in a mode of passion, it cannot have the sense of discrimination, the sense of discipline to know what to use and how much. Recently I was at a university about a year ago, and the registrar of the university had disconnected the Wi-Fi and banned Wi-Fi at night in the dormitories. And there was a hue and cry. The matter came up in the press, and then the media came out saying, you know, how can you restrict freedom is, you know, you're restricting freedom, and, you know, so on and so forth. The calls for freedom came out. And eventually, I believe the registrar had to go back on his decision. He reversed the decision, and then he had to restore that. So when I was there, do some programs with students, and they were all excited about this whole new development. And I said, why? The registrar must have had good reason. I mean, he wouldn't just do it for no reason at all. He said, yeah, the reason is that most of the students in the dormitory, they're up all night on the internet. And it's not that they're only looking out or that looking at chemical engineering or accounting or whatever. They're looking at everything else. And therefore, they go to sleep in the morning and they're not able to attend the classes because they're sleeping in their rooms and they should be attending the classes. And therefore, the attendance plummeted, the performance of the students in their studies plummeted, and the authorities were getting very worried, understandably. So this is the situation. When you actually go on the internet or anything else to get something done, 5% you get your things done, 90% you get distracted. That's actually what happens. You go to do surfing and everything. You go from one place to another, you forget why you came here in the first place. That's the nature of the way we have embraced modernism today. So I think we need to rethink on what real freedom is. We've got to go to higher concepts and deeper concepts to understand how we're getting enslaved more and more. And this is just technology. One could go on and on about technology. But let's talk about the simple things even. You go to the shopping malls, and the mesmerizing range of products on display, the fashionable clothing and everything else that goes with it, it's just mind-boggling. The whole array of things that are meant to distract our mind. Weapons of mass distraction, truly speaking. You go to any shopping center, go to any mall, you can't come away without buying something, even if you didn't have an intention to buy. And one of the principles of marketing is to persuade the customer to buy something that he doesn't really need. That's good marketing. Good advertising. And the more you succeed in making a person feel that he or she really needs it, when actually there is no need, that's how you sell your products. So the whole modern techno-commercial civilization is moving in a direction that's taking us away from our capacity to be in the moment. We're taken away everywhere. As it is, the mind is troublesome. And now, we're adding these distractions. And therefore, there's practically no hope left there. The ancient scripture, the Srimad Bhagavatam, speaks about three stages of our life, past, present, and future. And it says that we as human beings have a tendency to lament about the past, to be dissatisfied with the future, or with the present, I beg your pardon, and to be worried about the future. Does it make sense? We lament for the past. Someone's old things, oh, when I was young, I would do this and I would do that. Now I'm old. Oh, we always think, I wish I had done that last week, I didn't do that. Oh, what a mistake I made. We lament about the past. We're dissatisfied with the present. We want more. Oh, I wish I had more than what I have now. And we worry about the future. What if I lose what I have now? What if I don't get what I hope to get? And so we're constantly in anxiety. And either we are in the past lamenting, or we are in the future worrying, or we are in the present but fretting and fuming about what we could do to make our future better. A simple tool, therefore, is to hold the mind and say, when we are lamenting about the past, let bygones be bygones. Whatever somebody spoke to me 10 days ago, it may have been rude, it may have been harsh, doesn't matter, let me move on. These are the most important thing in my life. It's not my problem, it's that person's problem. If I start lamenting about or worrying about or feeling bad about what somebody said to me 10 days ago, and I'm smarting and thinking, what will I do to get back with this person? Probably in all likelihood that person has forgotten about it, or we are fretting and fuming about it. So let bygones be bygones, move on. Forget, forgive, and move on. And as for the present, relish it, rather than being dissatisfied. Contentment and satisfaction are great objects of wealth. A person who has contentment is wealthy. A person who is discontented in the midst of wealth is actually poverty-stricken. So contentment is an opulence. So instead of seeking more and more of this world, let's seek more and more internally, of the internal world. And as we move on to the world of goodness, eliminating the products of the modes of ignorance and passion, we find our mind becoming calmer, more peaceful and sober, and I start relishing everything I'm doing now. Life becomes so much more livable, so much more joyful. But then that's not enough. Ultimately, we have to come to the point of asking the question, what for? What am I living for? What is the purpose of my life? And this is the most important question we can ask ourselves, but unfortunately this is one question that we hardly ever ask ourselves. What is the purpose of my life? One time I was asking one gentleman, you know, because we have spiritual programs, and I had been inviting him to come on a couple of occasions, but he hadn't come. So I was asking him, I haven't seen you for quite a long time. Why didn't you come for our program sometime? He said, you know, I have no time. So I said, why? I said, because he said, I'm busy working. So I asked him, why? He said, well, for money. I said, why? He said, well, you know, for food. I said, why? He said, well, to survive, to live. I said, why? And he was thinking. It was a full stop. He didn't know. Well, it's a good question, he said. At least he was honest. He was humble. He admitted. But there is a problem. He doesn't know why he's living. He's born. He's going to die sometime. That we know. And everybody knows. And in the interim, between birth and death, we want to maximize our pleasure and minimize our distress. That's what life is all about, as far as the ordinary person is concerned. Is that all? Okay, I become a big executive, or I become a king or a queen or whatever, and I get loads of money, millions of pounds, and I spend my vacations in the Bahamas or in wherever else. And, all right, then what? What next? Is it all? There is the purpose to my life? And then I die and everything's finished. My money is gone, somebody else gets it. What happens to the body which I try to enjoy is gone. So thoughtful people try to probe into these questions, which are the most important. And that's a product of the mode of goodness. Until we bring our mind to the mode of goodness, we will not even be able to ask these questions. And even if these questions strike our minds, we will not be able to stay with these questions long enough to be able to ask them to somebody and get the answers that we need. To move from the present now to the eternal present continuous of the spiritual world. Time is present in a harsh way in this world in which we live. Time is an agent of destruction. Because eventually time destroys everything. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, time I am, destroyer of the worlds. There's an incident about the physicist Oppenheimer. He was associated with the first atom bomb, you know, in America. And he is said to have famously declared, when the test explosion happened at Nevada, wherever, Arizona, whichever place they had it in, and he quoted this verse from Bhagavad Gita, "Time I am, destroyer of all." So it's interesting. Time is a factor for destruction. When we're talking of being in the present, we should know that in this world, time is an agent of destruction. And therefore we have to rise the limitations, rise beyond the limitations imposed by time on a spiritual platform. On the spiritual platform, there's only the present continuous. On the material platform, time has a past, present, and future, and the future eventually ends in destruction. But beyond this world, there is another spiritual world, a world that is open to exploration, that our spaceships cannot go to, but our consciousness can go to. That's where we're supposed to be, in the present. And if you are spiritually conscious here and now, then you can also attain that realm of the present continuous, being eternally present, of that elixir of immortality, to live forever and ever. It's possible because the soul, by nature, according to Bhagavad Gita, is eternal. So what are some of those spiritual practices that we can do now, coming beyond the negatives and coming to the positives? The most frequently spoken about spiritual practice is meditation. But what does it mean to meditate? Meditate means to focus the mind on God. Meditating on anything else of this world will be not completely productive, because anything of this world will be flickering, will be temporary, and therefore the benefits of such meditation will also not be fruitful. So when we want to transcend matter or come to the platform of spirit, we have to meditate on something spiritual. And in this age, according to the Vedic scriptures, which is called Kali Yuga, this age, the age of quarrel, the age of hypocrisy, the process of meditation is to chant the names of God. It's a very intensely engaging and absorbing process. When we engage ourselves in the chanting of the names of God, either musically together, congregationally, or privately to ourselves, softly, on knees, or even within the mind, we experience great joy. We experience a transcending of the time and space of this world. We experience a joy that we probably didn't experience before. And that is how we can elevate our consciousness beyond matter to go into the present continuous, where your being for the moment will be a moment forever and ever and ever. This body, of course, will be destroyed eventually, but the soul is not destroyed. And therefore the soul will attain to its natural realm, to its constitutional position, to its natural environment. And that is the perfection of life. That is the goal of life. As we move on with such meditative practices and leading a life of calmness that subdues the modes of passion and ignorance within us, we will see the real mind, the friendly mind coming up. The Bhagavad Gita says when the mind is controlled, it's our best friend. When the mind is not controlled, it's our worst enemy. So we have to tame this enemy of ours who has enslaved us in such a cruel and harsh way, in his vice-like grip. We have to get free from him. We have to tame him, tame that lion, by these meditative spiritual practices, and by good company, and by associating the mode of goodness in all its aspects, in terms of place, time, company, books, knowledge, entertainment. And gradually we will see ourselves moving the vice-like grip of the modes of passion and ignorance will now start loosening, and gradually we will find ourselves being elevated to a higher platform of consciousness. That's called in Sanskrit Vishuddha Sattva, purified goodness. Something which makes us experience the joy that we've always been hankering for. I think I will stop here. I conclude with one line which Rakesh reminded me I concluded my speech last year. Thank you for reminding me, so I'll repeat it this time since you reminded me. And I concluded my speech last time by saying that we monks are sometimes like politicians, because once we get a mic in hand, we don't stop. So we go on and on and on. But even though I am in the present, but I must also see that time is passing and we must stop here. I do want to leave some time for questions as well. So thank you very much for your kind attention. Thank you very much for coming this evening. You've been a lovely audience. I didn't see a single person nodding off to sleep. So you were indeed very much present in the moment. And thank you very much for that. Shall we have a few questions, Bijan? Okay. So you may please feel free to just raise your hand and you can ask the question from wherever you are seated. Yes.
I also feel like a politician. Why is deep sleep more of ignorance? I don't understand.
Why is deep sleep more of ignorance? Because in the state of deep sleep, we are in forgetfulness. There's no knowledge. It's a lack of knowledge. When we're sleeping, we're completely ignorant of who we are, where we are, or anything of this sort. Not that deep sleep is not required. But deep sleep, more than necessary, is definitely something that's an activity in the world of ignorance. So to refresh body and mind, we need to be in deep sleep, actually. Sometimes when you sleep and wake up, you find yourself still feeling fatigued and not fresh. That's probably because you've dreamt too much, and you haven't been long enough in deep sleep. You've been hovering the platform of the mind, and therefore one doesn't feel rested. So deep sleep is essential for us, but in terms of its characteristics, it's in the mode of ignorance. So we utilize the mode of ignorance to some limited degree for this purpose. But when we overdo it, then it affects our consciousness. Yes. Can you pass on the mic, please?
You basically refer to mindfulness being distracted or hindered by addictions. So addictions, throughout your talk, addictions was the main thing that basically stops us from being mindful. But then what about a person who suffered trauma, or they have circumstances which takes them away from mindfulness, but it's not actually addictions, it's difficult circumstances.
So are you referring to, let's say, some mental health issues?
It doesn't have to even be mental health issues. It could be where somebody's physical needs are not met because they might not have a shelter, for example, or nutrition. Or if they suffered a very traumatic event in their lives.
Sure, definitely. These things are very disturbing and distracting, undoubtedly. However, the problem of distractions is also there for those who have these things. Those who have homes, big homes, for those who have food, enough food, have money, everything. So even though they have it, they're still distracted. So even though it is a fact that not having these things may cause distraction, and they do cause distraction, basically, But having them is no guarantee that you won't be distracted. So that's not the solution, really. The solution lies elsewhere, that we have to go beyond the platform of matter. We have to lift the mind to a higher level. Yes? Can we have a mic over there, please?
Hi, Mishnah Maharaj. Thank you for your talk. I just wondered, you mentioned about it's really important for us to ascertain what's the purpose of our life. So I was just wondering if you could give us a few more hints and tips as to when we ask ourselves that question, what's my purpose, why am I here, sort of our thought processes to work out what the answer to that would be.
Yes, indeed. Of course, being the most important question, it needs a lot of time. But let me answer it in as brief a way as I can. The purpose of life is to develop our relationship of love with the eternal spiritual being who is our source and the source of everything. That spiritual being may be called by different names, in different cultures, in different lands, in different faiths. But we, as spirit souls, have a relationship of love to Him. That relationship is eternal. The soul is eternal. That supreme soul is also eternal. We call Him Krishna. He's the all-attractive one. And to develop that relationship of love is a fulfillment of all our aspirations for love, happiness, and immortality in this world. Final question. Yes. Pass on mic, please.
This had a question on a more practical level, perhaps, about, you spoke for quite a while about the use of technology, particularly mobile phones, apps being connected to the internet and so on, as being a distraction, which is something I agree with. You also mentioned that you use these devices yourself. And I was just interested from your point of view, how you manage that on a day-to-day basis and how you avoid getting distracted yourself as a user.
Yeah, that's a good question. I minimize. For example, I don't carry a phone anymore. It helps. If there's something that's really so important, someone will get in touch with you somehow. They will. As far as emails, to be honest, I have many, many emails that I haven't replied. And I think people who correspond to me just have to accept that they're not going to get an immediate answer. And they just have to be patient if they want to write to me. It's just not realistic to answer hundreds of emails every day. It's just not going to happen. And as far as other things, we just have to draw a line and say, this is it. I have other things to do in life. I cannot just be all the time under the influence of all these electronic instruments. And why do I need to know everything that's on my mind? Everybody. And if you notice the things that people are sending out on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, they're not mostly earth-shaking things. They're mostly just inane trivia. There's just a lot of frivolity, a lot of unnecessary things that are just being talked about. I'm at London Airport. I'm eating a good sandwich, send it out. So, of course, therefore, everybody comments, what kind of sandwich are you eating? What a waste of time, isn't it? Couldn't all these people have done something useful at that time? It's just such a waste of time. So it's just basically understanding that it's a waste of time. So in trying to be in touch with everybody and anybody, we lose in touch with ourselves. That's the problem. The most important person in our life is ourselves, isn't it? Isn't it? So we're so busy just being in touch with everybody else that we don't know what we're doing. So I try to use a sense of discipline. But I must confess it's hard because just people expect. They expect replies, they expect me to call back, and so on and so forth. But we draw a line somewhere. So I use the technology, but I try to see that it's a tool. That these instruments become a tool in my hands. I try to ensure that I don't become a tool in the hands of these instruments. I'll tell you a little story. It's not exactly connected, but it's got a parallel. You heard of King Alexander. So he came all the way up to India, reached the Indus River. And then his soldiers were really tired. And they said, look, Alexander, we want to go back. We've had enough. So he said, all right, but I've come all the way here, and I've heard about the yogis and the saints here in this land. So let me take one back so that I can show them to people of my country. So then with difficulty found one in the forest who was deeply absorbed in meditation. So he went up to him. I guess he must have had an interpreter or something, translator. So he went up to him and said, I'm Alexander and I'm the king of Greece or Macedonia, whatever. And please come back with me to my country. I would like to take you back. So the saint told him, the yogi told him, no thank you, I'd rather stay here. Then Alexander insisted and tried to request him, persuaded him, he insisted, but this person wouldn't budge. Finally Alexander was getting angrier and angrier. He wasn't accustomed to people saying no. So finally he flew into a fit of rage and said, do you know who I am? And he was blazing, in blazing anger. Then this yogi very calmly replied. He said, you're the servant of my servant. Now that was really too much for Alexander. He became even more angry and he removed his sword from his sheath and he was about to attack this person and then somehow or the other, you know, good intelligence prevailed. And he said, let me hear what he means. I said, why do you say I'm the servant of your servant? So he said, you know, you are a servant of anger, and I am a master of anger. So you become the servant of my servant? Because anger is my servant. I can use anger when I want, but I don't get controlled by anger. Because anger is sometimes essential in this world, you see. So I can use anger, he said, when I want to. Anger is my servant. I can control it. I can use it as a tool when I want. But anger is your master, because anger has got the better of you. So therefore, because you are the servant of anger, and anger is my servant, therefore you are the servant of my servant. And Alexander was impressed. So in a similar way, I think we should try not to become servants of technology, servants of these instruments and appliances, servants of these shopping malls and so on, but rather we should make them tools and use them for a constructive purpose, for something that's really tangible and something of value. Okay, so thank you very much for your nice questions and for your attention. I hope and pray that you will make steady progress on this path of spiritual discovery. Thank you.